and welcome to Anne Boleyn's 1535 Reformation Progress, episode 6. I'm here with Sarah Morris from the Tudor Travel Guide, and I'm Vanessa Kane Tate from Secret London Runs. Hello, Sarah. How are you?
Hello, Vanessa. It's good to be back, and I'm very well this morning. It's such a bright, sunny morning. It's filled me with joie de vivre, and I'm ready to go.
It's gorgeous, isn't it? So we are now at the Vine, is that right?
Yes, in the last podcast episode, we travelled from Winchester all the way to the Vine. And so we're now in the glorious county of Hampshire, and we are arriving at the Vine, which according to Leyland, and I don't think I've talked about Leyland before during this particular, this whole series of podcasts, but Leyland was an antiquary of the period, and he tasked himself, or was tasked with, going about England and recording what he saw. And he's an amazing source of information for how Tudor England appeared, and particularly some of the most notable towns, cities and buildings. And he travelled through Hampshire and visited the Vine and called it one of the grandest houses in I think he called it Hamptonshire rather than Hampshire. So yeah, he noted it as being a particularly significant house.
Amazing. This job seems like if you lived in those times that you may have taken it on.
Do you know what, Vanessa? You are spot on. In fact, I thought it would make a great TV series to actually revisit the travels of John Leyland and just wander around in his footsteps. But yes, he has my dream job, basically. I think he's amazing.
The TV show sounds great, Sarah. I think that lots of our listeners would be interested, but I'm not certain that John Leyland's trips across England would be a Netflix smash hit.
Sadly, I think you're correct. Yes, I know. I can't understand why. Anyway, but there's an interesting fact about John Leyland. We know where he lived, actually. We lived in Charterhouse Square in London, which was a very fashionable, swanky square. Ooh. And eventually he went mad, which was really sad, in fact.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
Do we know what made him?
No, I don't think so. There's just records of him eventually just going insane. So I don't know whether that's what happens to people who travel around England in the footsteps.
It's not looking good, Sarah.
Oh dear. Watch this space.
So back to the progress. When did Henry and Anne arrive at the Vine?
So believe it or not, we're now in mid-October. Yeah, I know. Remember, we set off in early July. It's now mid-October, and they arrived there on the 15th of October and stayed for sort of 4 or 5 days, not leaving till the following Tuesday. And while they were there, they were guests of William Sands, who was at the time Henry VIII's Lord Chamberlain.
What does a Lord Chamberlain do?
That's a good question. Now, some of our listeners may remember that we did touch on this in a previous podcast, that the royal household was divided into two main households. There was the kind of the public household and all the offices which looked after the running of the household, and that was presided over by a guy called the Lord Steward. And it was always a nobleman. It was an official position and one of some rank and status. And then the privy apartments, so all those chambers that were private, were presided over by the Lord Chamberlain. And Henry VIII would have had both a Lord Steward and a Lord Chamberlain. And of course, Anne Boleyn had her own privy apartments. And so she had a separate, a different Lord Chamberlain.
And Sands was Henry's Lord Chamberlain or Anne's?
Yeah. William Sands was Henry's Lord Chamberlain. So he was responsible for just making sure that everything that happened within the privy chambers went according to the book and everything ran smoothly. Everybody behaved themselves appropriately. He was responsible for the order of the privy chambers.
And do we know much about what Henry and Anne got up to at the Vine?
Not a lot, sadly. There are really not much records at all. We know that it wasn't their first visit there. If I remember rightly, they visited earlier on in the 1530s, I think 1531. But I suppose what's most interesting about the Vine is some of the architectural features. We haven't spoken too much about the interiors of some of the properties that Henry and Anne visited, but I do think it's worth just touching on some of the features that are associated with the Vine, because they do have a couple of features in the Vine, the chapel and the Long Gallery, which are contemporary to the 16th century. And the Long Gallery in particular is one of the few remaining early 16th century long galleries in England. And it has a very beautiful and exquisite interior. Unlike many chambers of the time, which might have been hung with tapestries, that wasn't needed at the Vine in Hampshire, because the whole wall was carved with oak wooden panels, carved with emblems of all of William Sand's contemporaries. And so it was almost like it was almost like a who's who of the Tudor court of the period. So if you go and visit today, you'll see that there is a carved pomegranate of Catherine of Aragon on some of the panels. You'll see initials of T.W., Thomas Wolsey. You'll see William Sands' emblems and his initials. So it's, we always thought when Natalie and I were writing in the footsteps, we always wondered what they did with the Catherine of Aragon emblems when Anne Boleyn was visiting, because of course it wasn't the done thing.
Yeah, well, there was in the last time we were talking, you thought that maybe someone had come and painted over it, but I guess you what house was that at?
That was Brockworth Court. That was when we were in Gloucester.
But you can't paint over a wood carving, can you?
Not really.
Maybe. I mean, they would have had a lot of surplus tapestries that they'd been carrying around in the progress, wouldn't they? Maybe they just popped one over the pomegranate and...
I did wonder. I don't know, but you know, it does make one pause for thought of how they manage some of these delicacies, you know, delicate aspects of a new queen at Henry's side.
It's such an interesting idea, isn't it, to get all of your friends carved into the wall of your home.
It is really, and you know, William Sands, I think, managed to steer a fairly neutral path through the various religious changes. But I think on the whole, he was probably loyal to the Aragonese and the Catherine of Aragon first and foremost, although I don't think he showed any kind of antipathy towards Anne Boleyn, which was probably why he was honoured with a visit. We should remember that not only was this progress featured in terms of religious reform, Henry VIII honoured a large number of courtiers who were also supportive of his marriage to Anne. And so he was very pointedly did that on this progress. So although I don't think William Sands was particularly an Anne Boleyn fan, he was one of those people, just like we'll see in the next property, like Sir William Paulette, who owned the next property we're going to go to, managed to navigate that path. He was just discreet and able to navigate that very, very tricky path between Catholic, Reformed religion, between Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, etc. But it is quite an undertaking. And going back to your point, I have pondered about what would have made William Sands think about putting all these initials right the way down the gallery, knowing that people came and went from favour.
You could imagine putting people from the past there, can't you? But So this is in the Long Gallery. Do you know what's a Long Gallery? What happens in a Long Gallery?
So a long gallery really was came into being around this period for the first time. Early medieval houses didn't have, there was no such thing as a long gallery. It was an innovation of its day. And a long gallery was just that. It was a very long, almost elongated corridor, and it often connected two ranges of a building in a grand house such as the Vine. So at the Vine, we know, for example, that this long gallery connected the king and the queen's sides. And it had a couple of purposes, really. First and foremost, it was used as a place for exercise when the weather was poor, inclement, because I think we've touched on before, Vanessa, that the Tudors liked to live outdoors and spent an awful lot of time outdoors. But of course, when the weather was poor, they still wanted to take exercise. They still wanted to entertain themselves. So these long spaces, long, broad galleries allowed them to walk and even do such things as practice their archery. That is...
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. There is, in fact, a record of Henry VIII practicing his archery in the Long Gallery at the Moor, which originally had been one of Thomas Wolsey's properties. So, you know, they would have strolled, they would have walked, they would have talked, they would have probably had musicians, maybe they played musical instruments, they did things like archery. So that was one reason. That was a kind of an entertainment or a place to exercise when the weather was bad. And then I've touched on the other, particularly in the royal palaces, galleries often connected the king and queen's sides. And they were private galleries, which meant that, you know, they weren't accessible to the wider court. So this meant there was a private space for the king and queen to pass between each other's bedrooms. Notably, the king, if he wanted to sleep with his wife, could pass via his privy gallery and get to the queen's bedchamber, which was often sited at the other end of the gallery or close to the other end of the gallery. So it allowed a degree of privacy in these great royal houses, which were otherwise constantly under the prying eyes of a wider court. And the final thing is they allowed you to show off some of your finest paintings or, you know, other objects. So we know, I think it's at Hampton Court, Henry had an absolutely gorgeous long gallery that no longer exists. And there were all sorts of musical instruments and other scientific devices that, you know, were on display there. So a sumptuous place to display your wealth.
Yeah. So at the Vine, if we were to visit today, we'd still see this beautiful long gallery. What else is left?
Yeah. So the long gallery sadly has been a little bit truncated. It's probably not as long as it originally was, but it's long enough. If you walk through that door at the end, you'll go, wow, this is wonderful.
A slightly less long gallery.
A slightly less long gallery. And you'll also notice that above one of the doorways, there is a royal coat of arms. And it's believed that that doorway would have led into the principal chambers that would have been used by Lord Sandys or William Sandys normally, but was used probably by Henry VIII when he was at residence in the Vine. Sadly, the privy chambers used by Anne Boleyn completely gone. There's only about, I think it's about 20% to 30% of the Vine, the original house still exists. The rest of it has completely disappeared over time. And unfortunately, those privy chambers on the king's side, although they occupy the footprint, the interiors have been much remodeled. But the other major 16th century feature is the chapel, which does survive. You have the antechapel and then the main body of the chapel. And there are various architectural features like the choir stalls and the tiling in front of the high altar, and also stained glass windows. So you'll see three stained glass windows. One depicts Henry VIII, aged about 30, with his patron saint, Saint Henry of Antioch, I think it is. And then you also have Catherine of Aragon to his left with her patron saint. And on the right, the final stained window, which actually depicts Margaret Tudor, who became Queen of Scotland, with her patron saint. So there's some lovely architectural features in there that are all contemporary to the Tudor period, which you can enjoy.
And you can visit, it's open to the public, is it?
Yeah, it's a National Trust property. So it's open to the public most of the year. And yeah, and sometimes they used to have Tudor events because I used to do some reenactment there as well. I don't think they do at the moment, but they have lots of events as National Trust properties do. But yes, it's open to the public and a lovely place to visit.
Nice. And so Henry and Anne were there for 5 or 6 days and then I guess they moved on?
Yes, yes. They stayed there around about 5 days and then they moved on only a relatively short distance, actually, to another Tudor property, medieval property called Bram's Hill. Now, it's an interesting story at this point because they were never meant to go to Bram's Hill. It wasn't in the original Geists. They were basically the sort of the calendar, the agenda of where the royal couple were due to visit. And it was always laid out before the couple went on progress. But they didn't always stick to it. And one of the reasons they didn't always stick to that sort of itinerary was due to disease. And we've already mentioned earlier in one of the other podcasts that plague was rife in England at the time. And in fact, it was also, there was an outbreak of plague around the towns of Alton and Farnham, which people who are listening to this who live in the area will no doubt know them. Those towns obviously still exist. But perhaps on account of that, they diverted away from the original itinerary. They were going to go to a place called Eltham. I think that's how you pronounce it. And interestingly, Vanessa, this place was owned by none other than Sir Edward Seymour. Recognise the name?
Just a little bit, yeah.
So Sir Edward Seymour, of course, eventually became a very important man. He was the elder brother of Jane Seymour. We know that Henry and Anne had already been to Wolf Hall, and it seems that they were due to grace another Seymour property. But for some reason, and we don't really know why, although I've postulated in our In the Footsteps book, we don't really know why, but they didn't get there. Instead, they went to Bram's Hill. And Bram's Hill...
Are we allowed to hear your postulation from In the Footsteps?
I'll go on then. You twisted my arm.
It's too juicy, Sarah, not to mention.
I love, what I'm about to say, we don't know whether this is the truth, but what is true is that Bram's Hill was owned by kinsfolk of Anne Boleyn. So her aunt, which was the younger sister of her mother, her name was Catherine Howard. The Howard clan was vast. If anybody's ever looked at the size of the Howard family, you'll know that it was huge. And the age difference between Anne's mother, Elizabeth, and the youngest child was enormous. I mean, it was like, you know, I can't remember exactly, but it's something like 20 to 30 years. It's absolutely enormous. So Catherine Howard was Anne Boleyn's aunt, and she was married to Lord Daubeny, who owned Bram's Hill. And it's interesting because the Daubeny marriage was in trouble. Henry Daubeny, Lord Daubeny, had married Catherine, but had been trying to get the marriage annulled for some reason. And I'm not really sure why, and I'm not really sure it's recorded why. But the couple were estranged and apparently living apart. But I couldn't help but wonder whether... were they truly living physically apart, or were they just living apart within the same large, very large house? And I couldn't help wonder whether Anne Boleyn wanted to go and see her aunt. It does seem, Vanessa, that Catherine Howard, and it's not Catherine Howard as in Queen Catherine Howard, we're still talking about Anne's aunt here, was quite close to Elizabeth Boleyn, because she would be, in fact, the chief mourner at Elizabeth Boleyn's funeral in 1538. So there does seem to be some closeness there. And I do wonder whether Anne wanted to go and see if she could try and help the marital strife, whether she could do anything to try and reconcile the two, or just to give support to her aunt. Sadly, we'll never know.
That's a lovely theory. So I guess at this point, it was almost, could it have been a choice between going to a Boleyn residence and a Seymour residence, and they obviously picked Boleyn.
Well, I like to think so. I mean, we you probably know, Vanessa, I don't believe that Jane Seymour was first seen by Henry VIII at Wolf Hall. She had been in Anne's service for a while. Henry VIII would have known her. Whether something happened there, though, that caused Henry to look at Jane Seymour again or in a different light, well, that might be another story, as we'll come to talk about in the next podcast. By January 1536, so just 2 or 3 months later, we know that Henry VIII had started to shower Jane Seymour with attention and gifts. So maybe something did happen at Wolf Hall. And maybe Anne was aware of that and definitely wanted to not only support her kinswoman, but maybe steer Henry VIII's philandering eye away from the Seymour family.
Let's not put the Seymours with all of their male children right in front of Henry's eyes, perhaps. Maybe that's not what what yeah. Anne would have wanted.
Exactly. I mean, we do know but that by that time, Sir Edward Seymour had caught Henry's attention. You know, he was a rising star at court. So who knows kind of what shenanigans Edward already had in mind? Who knows what happened at Wolf Hall? We don't know. But I just smell something fishy, Vanessa, going on here.
Yeah. Well, we know, don't we, that when someone was visited by the Royal Progress, it put that family in the spotlight, didn't it? So you can see why Anne wouldn't have wanted to do that. But you think that could be one solution. There's this wanting to visit the aunt, and there's a possible plague that put them off going there.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether the plague certainly played a part in changing the original geists, as I say, I never know how to say it, away from Alton and Farnham. I'm not quite sure when Eltham came into the picture. It's not entirely evident from the records, but just at the very last minute, I mean, even when the couple were at the Vine, they were still planning on going to Eltham, I think. It's still mentioned in a contemporary letter. So it was a really last minute change of plan. Now, whether, you know, there were suddenly reports of plague around that area or whether Anne just exerted her influence on Henry at the very last minute. Who knows? We don't know, and sadly.
Wow. So what happened when they got there?
They literally only stayed overnight at Bram's Hill. And the story of the house itself is, I think for Tudor lovers is a little bit sad in that the house that is there today is a Jacobean replacement of the original sort of medieval Tudor house, but which was probably partly incorporated into the Jacobean redevelopment. So you can see fragments of the house, like part of the Great Hall still exists. But my sadness about Bram's Hill is the fact that it was a police college, a national police college, until a few years ago when we were writing In the Footsteps, and I got to go round it and have a look at it and at least get to see it. But actually, a few years ago, it was sold to a private developer and converted into private residences. And at the time of updating In the Footsteps, there were plans to have the grounds open, but of course, private residences would mean that the general public wouldn't be able to get access to it. So I remember well the final open day at Bram's Hill, which I attended in costume, of course. And it was quite sad, of course. Okay, any excuse. Yeah. But it was quite sad knowing that actually this was kind of probably the last time that it was going to be available for people to see.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing that you got to see it.
Yeah, I'm very grateful, because just a few years later, and that may well not have been possible at all. So yeah, I'm very grateful. I'd love to go back and see what they've actually done with it. Obviously, it would be a protected building, so there would be only a certain amount of changing of certain features they would be able to do.
So do you know much about what it was like when Henry and Anne were there? What sort of house was it?
Yeah, we do actually. There's been a lady who did, I think, her MA, and so you probably could track it down online, but she'd studied what the original house would have looked like. And we know that it was a large single courtyard manor house with probably three or four ranges, with all the relevant service offices and the Great Hall, etc. So she's put together a conjectural floor plan of what the building would have looked like. I don't think we have any records of what the interiors looked like, but it was surrounded by a beautiful hunting park. And I think it was noted in particular for kind of the beauty of its surroundings.
So do you think Henry and Anne had time for a bit of hunting whilst they were there?
Do you know, I'm not sure they did, because it was literally an overnight stop. And as we've seen in this progress, quite often, Henry and Anne would at least stay a couple of days, if not 4 or 5 days, in the various places. This seems to have been a fleeting visit. And so if they arrived on one day, I can't imagine that they would have had a lot of time to turn things around, get out hunting, come back, and then head off the next day. So I do wonder whether this would have been a day where maybe Anne just had a chance to catch up with her aunt. Again, it's lots of conjecture here going on, but what we do know is they stayed overnight and they were moving on the next day, and the next stop was the final one on the progress.
So where was that?
The last stop on the progress was a place called East Hampstead, which is very close to Bracknell. So we've moved out of Hampshire. Bramshill was the last place in which Henry and Anne were in Hampshire. And of course, they'd had a wonderful time in that county. They'd really elongated the progress. They were never meant to be away for as long as they were. I think the original progress was about 2 months, but they'd had such a good time perambulating around Hampshire and Wiltshire in particular, that the progress was way overdue in terms of its intended time of their arrival back in Windsor. But East Hampstead, near to Bracknell. And again, this was one of those locations I did go and visit, although I knew there would be nothing to see, because there is, in fact, nothing to see, folks. It's very sad, actually, because it was a royal hunting lodge. And if you ever had a chance to look at it on the map, you'll see that it lies kind of south of Windsor. It was actually on the edge of Windsor Great Park. So it was part of that vast hunting park, which encircled or was, you know, sort of part of the Windsor estate. And it was used as a hunting lodge right the way through the medieval period. Many, many medieval kings issued various proclamations at East Hampstead. And from a Tudor point of view, the most interesting event was that it was at East Hampstead that Henry VIII rode out to meet the young Catherine of Aragon, who had, of course, arrived from Spain. And it was at East Hampstead that they had that first evening of celebration, where the young Prince Henry first saw Catherine of Aragon, and I believe, if I'm right, led her in a dance. So it was the very first place that Henry laid eyes on Catherine. Of course, we all know what happened from there. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing.
There's nothing left of this place that's linked to so much history.
I know, it's so sad. It's whatever remains underground. And I think it's on the edge of a golf course today and a kind of a modern day housing estate. So yes, I wouldn't recommend, unless you really love going and just standing, taking in a vibe with absolutely nothing to see, I wouldn't recommend going and visiting the East Hampstead location.
So how long were they at East Hampstead for, do we know?
Yes, we do, actually. They were there for a few days. They spent another sort of 4 days at East Hampstead. So they were really eking it out. They clearly were in no rush.
Yeah, like just one more week of our holiday.
Yes, I don't want to go home. Yes, so they stayed at East Hampstead for 4 days. And, you know, by this time, of course, we're 26th of October. It's the end of October. So summer is long gone. Autumn must have been well encroaching across the land with a sort of chill in the air. And finally, the royal procession must have made their way through Windsor Great Park to get back to Windsor, I'm assuming, on the 26th of October. So yeah, nearly what I think it's... July, August, September. We're talking 3.5 months after initially setting out from the castle.
Wow. And do we know how things were with Henry and Anne?
Well, what we do know is that there is a stream of letters that are constantly being sent by various courtiers whilst the progress is happening. And I think we probably mentioned this in an earlier podcast, but it is worthwhile just saying again that even as late as, I think, the Vine, in fact, it was Bramshill, there was a letter from Sir Francis Bryan saying very specifically that the king was merry. And it wasn't the first time that we'd heard that word being used with regards to Henry and Anne during their progress through Hampshire. So I think all was well. And as perhaps we will talk about in the next podcast, certainly the king and queen had regained a degree of intimacy, because it would be not too much later, probably around the Christmas time perhaps, that Anne would realise that she was once again with child. And so, yes, one imagines that things were going quite well by the end of the progress.
Amazing. Well, I look forward to talking about that in the next podcast. So now we're going to invite our lovely listeners to complete the final few miles of their journey. And we'll be back, both of us, at Windsor. So well done, everyone. You've done an amazing, amazing job. And we'll see you at Windsor. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Yes, I look forward to seeing you there, because the story doesn't end, of course. We want to wrap up by telling you what happened next. So this is the aftermath to the progress.
Amazing. Thanks so much.
Bye.